You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
All righty. I think we're going to start. I know there are people still coming up from lunch, but we've got a pretty short time frame, and I thought we have a lot to cover here, so I wanted to go ahead and start the panel. Welcome. Good afternoon. I'm Mary Ellen Callahan, and I've got a very distinguished group of people here. I'm not going to belabor introducing them. Their bios are all available. I did want to note that Jason Weinstein is unable to join us today. So I will be surrounded by four men with beards or very, very sundry elements of beards. Richard, you really got to work on that. Seriously, I talked to you about that. And so welcome to the alliterative panel, the post-Petraeus privacy, passion, and probable cause with the silent P. We have a lot of different issues to cover, but let me kind of set the stage and do some framework for everybody, which is I'm going to lay out some of the Petraeus facts so that we all kind of have the same understanding of what the facts are in the public domain. Then we're going to talk a little bit about Petraeus specifically and then talk more broadly about government access to information and what standard is appropriate, what scope is appropriate, are there analogies to other privacy laws that could be very helpful here. So let me kind of just set the stage. We're in steamy hot Tampa and in a classic Real Housewives of Tampa environment, literally and figuratively. A socialite, Jill Kelly, complains to a personal friend who works at the FBI that somebody is sending her harassing emails. And the subject of it may or may not involve her work with CENTCOM as being a social liaison to the neighborhood. Jill Kelly then, according to public sources, meets with the FBI Tampa and may or may not provide the six emails in question. Whether or not she provides consent to store her stored emails and the scope of that consent is unclear. But for purposes of this communication, let's assume that she did not provide consent beyond the six emails that she provided to the FBI. The FBI investigates email harassment. The FBI identifies Broadwell as the anonymous emailers through Wi-Fi and ISP records. The FBI obtains legal process, likely a search warrant, to access additional Broadwell email accounts, including a Gmail account where Director Petraeus and Paula Broadwell engaged in a dialogue in the draft folder of the email account. It is through this process that we understand that the CIA director was identified. And just to talk about the legal process, at this point, no charges of harassment have been brought against Broadwell. There's no allegation of a criminal act here. Petraeus, of course, has resigned his position as CIA director after the fact of the investigation and unearthing of the affair was brought to his attention. And the facts of the investigation, the reason why any of us know this information, is that there were a series of off-the-record anonymous sources that indicated that involved Kelly's initial complaint, conclusions about Broadwell, how they found the information, and the information in the Gmail draft folder. Whether or not the director used his CIA.gov email address for inappropriate communications, the answer is no, but we know that answer because of these off-the-record statements. And we also know about a seemingly unrelated correspondence that Jill Kelly had between General Allen and herself, alleging to be 20,000 emails. And again, there's no allegation of crime, and there appears to be no indictment in that circumstance pending. So that kind of sets the stage for our post-Petraeus privacy, passion, and probable cause discussion. And so I want to turn it over, maybe focusing specifically with Kevin, Julian, and with Mike about, kind of really the questions that are posed here is, under what authority was the FBI able to gain access to this information? And how could a relatively minor harassment complaint from a Florida socialite to a friend, candidly, lead to this sweeping search of information and actually the disclosure of that information? So maybe we'll turn it over to Kevin.
Sure, I'll give it a start. Just quickly, who I am. Free Expression Director at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Prior to that, I was at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where I worked a lot with CDT on our Digital Due Process Coalition and Initiative to Reform ECPA. To answer the question, what we're hearing is that likely warrants were used to obtain the emails in question, including the emails that were exchanged through the drafts folder of a Gmail account between General Petraeus and Paula Broadwell. And one of the reasons we suspect that a warrant was obtained for these emails from a Gmail account is because Google has stated that it requires warrants for Gmail as a result of a ruling in the Sixth Circuit called U.S. v. Warshak, which found that we have a Fourth Amendment reasonable expectation of privacy in our email. I'm very glad of that opinion because the statutes that cover our email privacy right now are the statute, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, is a bit strange and rather outdated, leading to the result that under ECPA, arguably, the emails in that draft folder would have only required a subpoena. Why is that? Well, under the Department of Justice's reading of ECPA, the most private email that you have is all of the unopened spam in your spam folder. That definitely requires a warrant, according to the DOJ. Everything else doesn't, because one, under ECPA, emails older than 180 days old don't require a warrant, based on the way that email computer systems worked in 1986, the year ECPA was passed. The government also believes that once you've opened an incoming email, that's no longer an electronic communication storage, but instead is in a different type of storage called remote computing service storage, which doesn't get warrant protection. Under similar reasoning, they think that all the email in your sent box and all the email in your draft folder only requires a subpoena. CDT, Google, a wide variety of other civil society organizations and companies, including Amazon and AT&T and Microsoft and many others, think this is crazy and outdated and want to fix it. But in the meantime, we have a number of companies like Google, like Facebook, like several others that have been relying on this Warshak opinion to demand warrants when the government comes calling, and that's why we hope and expect warrants were used here.
Mike, I don't know if you have any thoughts at this point.
No, I think that's right, and I think ultimately the constitutional issue turns on whether the so-called third-party doctrine is still a valid doctrine. And that's the doctrine that says that if you entrust a communication or some other information to a third party, you lose any reasonable expectation of privacy, whether it's a bank record or a communication. And courts have continued generally to say that that doctrine is valid because it comes from two Supreme Court cases several decades ago. And interestingly, the most interesting aspect to me of the U.S. v. Jones opinion, which was the one that said that you need a warrant to install a GPS tracking device on someone's car, the most interesting part of that was Justice Sotomayor's concurrence, in which she said, you know, it's about time that we reevaluate the third-party doctrine and determine whether it's still viable or not. Because if it is viable, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in any communication, regardless of how old it is, what folder it resides in, because Google or Yahoo or Microsoft or whatever provider you use has the ability to access that communication. I think there's a valid, very strong and valid criticism that that doctrine makes no sense whatsoever, because it would, I think most people would reasonably say, yes, I expect privacy in my email because I don't expect Google or Microsoft or Yahoo to actually read it just because they have that capability. And even if they do, I certainly don't expect law enforcement to be able to access it without some sort of lawful process. So whatever one thinks of ECPA, even today it still provides more protection than the Fourth Amendment does if you believe the third-party doctrine is still viable. So I think that's ultimately the question courts are going to need to wrestle with.
So maybe let's talk about the third-party doctrine a little bit. Mike did a great job of summarizing what the issues are and kind of the conclusions of these, you know, 1970s cases in dealing with whether or not you give information to, if you release it to anybody, even if they're acting on your behalf, even if they've made certain promises, the third-party doctrine would trigger. Does that make sense in today's world? And if not, what would alternative thoughts be in the ECPA context in particular, but also in general kind of communications privacy?
Well, I'll take a shot at that.
Yeah, go ahead, Richard.
So I'm the director at Google for law enforcement and information security, so I oversee the work that the company does when it receives legal process for the production of user data. Our philosophy around it generally is that it's actually a security and privacy issue around your data as a user of our services. We would like the law to be consistent with your reasonable expectations of how we're going to handle your data when it comes to government demands for data. Our view is that the statute as it is written right now is out of compliance with the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution because it would allow for the production of the content of communications to government on something less than a search warrant. And to that extent, it's constitutionally flawed. And just as significant for Google, frankly, is that we approach these issues from the point of view of the user in some respect, that our policies and practices are designed to try to take care of our users. And if there's a production rule out there that says we have to disclose and it's not consistent with what our users reasonably should expect, it's a problem for us as well. And our view is that we need to get the statute updated to get it back in line with how people are actually using this cloud services, not just Google services, but all the services that are out there. And you know, it's really tremendous. Most of these services are free. They're very rich in the features they provide to you. They're part of our life. We're frustrated when we're unable to get to access to our services, like in the basement of a hotel. All of which just kind of underpins this is part of our daily lives. We ought to protect it to the extent that it plays such an important role in our lives. So we're a big advocate for updating the statute so that it corrects that. I actually think it's a good statute. And there's a lot of things that are in that statute that Mike pointed out that are very good for privacy, good for our users, recognize the need of law enforcement to get to the data when it needs the data. And I don't think we need to just totally rip that statute apart, but there are some ways we need to update it so that it's more consistent with the way the web is relied on by your average person now.
Julian?
Sure. Julian Sanchez, a research fellow at the Cato Institute. I should add, I think, not just that the third-party doctrine doesn't make sense today, but it didn't really make sense in the 70s either. There's a great paper by Susan Freiwald that sort of breaks down how the court sort of confusingly mashed up a series of precedents, some involving confidential informants, some involving documents that were basically already sort of destined for production to the government, tax documents. And the application in this case to records generally is sort of illogical. I mean, it's not really consistent with the doctrine in Katz, involving telephone wiretaps, right? The phone company has technically access to your phone conversations. They could record them, and that no one imagines that means that you surrender your Fourth Amendment privacy interest in your telephone conversations. And indeed, the legal procedures governing telephone wiretaps look sort of absurdly different. There's not just a regular warrant, but what has sometimes been called a super warrant is required in those cases, involving showings of necessity and exhaustion of other alternative means, usually fairly strict limits and on the scope of the surveillance. So, 30 days or 60 days instead of years potentially with email. So I think actually the content stuff is a no-brainer, right? We've talked about in the context of the Petraeus case is, well, they should need a warrant. And probably they did get a warrant to read her emails. And the way the courts seem to be going is increasingly toward recognizing that they had better get a warrant to read the content of emails. I think one thing the Petraeus case points out is that there's also an issue with metadata, traditionally considered a lot less sensitive, and this is actually what some of these original third-party doctrine cases were about, not the content of telephone calls, but the numbers dialed and received from a particular phone. We assume, of course, that the metadata, the transactional data, is not that sensitive, and the contents are the sensitive stuff. But, of course, in this case, Paula Broadwell was sending to someone who voluntarily turned them over the contents of the emails. What was sort of sensitive or secret there was the identity of the sender. And a lot of stuff on the internet is sort of like that. There's something as post it on a forum or you have an anonymous blog, and the content is actually supposed to be public. It's who's writing it. That's the sensitive element. In this case, again, we don't know exactly what they did, but at least one news outlet, Reuters, reported that the FBI used administrative subpoenas, meaning they didn't even go to a prosecutor or impanel a grand jury, but just used their own authority to obtain the metadata that allowed them to track these emails back to Broadwell's account, because she was connecting to her regular, with her name on it, Google account, and her sort of secret anonymous Gmail account from the same IP addresses. That's a little weird if that's true, because the FBI does not have administrative subpoena authority for cyberstalking cases, so it is something of a mystery exactly how that was carried out. But there are recognized to constitutional issues with exposing the identity of anonymous speakers, not actually mostly from the Fourth Amendment lines of cases, but from the First Amendment line. There's a famous case, it's a First Amendment case called NAACP v. Alabama, in which the Supreme Court held, and this has been reaffirmed repeatedly over the years, that the state of Alabama could not require the NAACP to turn over a list of members and disclose that, because it would chill the First Amendment right to what the court called expressive association. And you sort of have to wonder now if instead it had been the NAACP Google group, would there have been an issue? You know, would they have just subpoenaed it? And then instead of the subpoena going to the NAACP, which might at least have the you know, the background knowledge necessary to challenge it, it would go to Google, which lacks that context and, frankly, that incentive, even though, you know, Richard is very assiduous about protecting our rights. And that's actually a much harder question, because you don't actually want to say, kind of in general, all subscriber information or records, including non-content, require a full-blown warrant. But, so it's harder to distinguish there which categories of information, given the investigatory purpose, are sufficiently sensitive that, you know, maybe a subpoena is not enough to obtain it. And just as a last sort of remark, I should say it's appropriate that we're doing this right after Martin Luther King Day, because, you know, we talk about the privacy issues here as though they're really about ordinary Americans. Historically, what's a lot more common is the kind of thing we see in the Petraeus case, where surveillance ends up being used, probably not intentionally in this case, but to destroy the careers or lives of prominent political figures. That Martin Luther King was, of course, probably one of the most famous of those. The FBI recorded his extramarital affairs, then sent him the tapes with a letter essentially insisting that he commit suicide or he would be exposed. This was obviously somewhat less drastic than that, but it is a reminder that intelligence abuses have historically been political abuses with political targets.
So when we talk about the access to the information and the use of the information and kind of the scope of the information, Richard, you referred to the fact that you facilitate the types of requests. I think Julian gives a really interesting example of the NAACP Google groups, right, in a hypothetical case, not saying that you do it. I mean, it's an interesting question is, in this networked, infrastructured, multi-dimensional element in which we communicate every day, you know, with the third-party doctrine in place, how is it that a company can defend the rights of the person with whom they have a communication? And then relatedly, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the information that Google released right at the beginning of the year about the type of law enforcement requests for information that you've gotten and the types of requests that they are.
Sure. I'd be happy to talk about that. So, you know, I'll start with that and give folks an idea of the kind of volume that Google is talking about when it comes to government demands for data. We publish statistics every 6 months covering the previous two quarters of the year on the number of demands we get and the number of accounts at issue in those demands. In the last, I think it was the first 6 months of 2012 in our last transparency report, as it's called, there were about 21,000 demands that came in covering about 35,000 accounts. So when you're talking about a company like Google, lots of companies get a lot more than us, and I think a lot of companies get a lot less than us. It's actually an issue of scale. We have to deal with these as they come in. There's a high volume of them. So it's a very bad combination of a high scale of work that comes in and yet at the same time requires a good deal of care and attention. It's just not churned through. So that presents a challenge for a company like Google that when we see something that looks like it might be an effort to go after somebody because they've been exercising freedom of expression, we would like to catch those. We would like to make sure the user knows about that demand. And in some situations, we may even want to step in and assert the rights of the user under First Amendment grounds in those cases. Very hands-on. You have to be able to identify it. Then you have to be able to do something about it. It's tricky at the kind of volumes and at the speeds we have to operate at because of the volume of these things. Nonetheless, it's important to us, and so we do, in fact, try to do that. So the hypothetical that Julian presented is one where that is a situation where we might fight to be able to give notice to the user that the request had come in so that the users would have an opportunity to oppose the request. Or we might even go in ourselves and try to seek relief from the request on the First Amendment grounds or other bases. It's not always just the Fourth Amendment. That certainly is one of the more common. But you know, as far as the way the company can, from its limited visibility into what the investigation is, our limited ability to see really what the data is about, the key components are trying to give the user notice so that the user who will have more context than we have will have an opportunity to do something about it. There are times when we're able to narrow the requests. If it comes in and it just looks too broad, we may go back to the agent and say, do you really need this? How about limiting it by time? How about by limiting it through some objective criteria that we'd be able to apply, get it narrowed a little bit so that the production becomes smaller than what it would have been absent that work. It is difficult. I mean, I'm not complaining about it. It's good work. It's important. But given the volume that we're facing, it is something that's a little tricky to do, but that's what we aspire to do.
So speaking of the you know, working with them and narrowing it, I mean, one of the questions that came to my mind in reading the fact pattern I read on Petraeus is, you know, are there limits or boundaries to law enforcement authority once some sort of threshold, and in this circumstance probable cause, may have been met? And, you know, what do we do on scoping? I've talked to a couple of different people who are the recipient of these types of law enforcement requests, and candidly, the scope's all over the map in terms of everything to a discrete element, and what makes sense both from a policy perspective and maybe even from a legislative perspective. So I'll go back to you, Kevin.
So I made mention of this 180-day rule in ECPA. And one of the reasons we have that is because of the way email worked 25 years ago, 25 plus, because we would dial into our BBS and pull down email, and we wouldn't leave it on a server. And if we did leave it on a server, it'd get deleted within 6 months because, you know, server space was expensive. And if we didn't dial it and pull it down, we probably had abandoned it and abandoned any privacy interest in it as well. The cloud has radically changed that. As Cory Doctorow puts it, storage is as cheap as borscht now. I'm assuming that borscht is very cheap. And we have these services where we are storing years and years of our emails. We aren't even bothering to delete stuff that we don't care about because what's the point? And hey, we might need it eventually. Sometimes even the interface itself encourages you not to bother deleting by requiring a few clicks before you can actually delete it fully from your account. So you end up having years upon years, thousands upon thousands of emails, which in fact we saw in this case where there were apparently thousands and thousands of pages of exchanges between Jill Kelly and General John Allen. This leads to the question, well, what does the government get when it investigates you or Jill Kelly or General Allen or whoever else? What we hear anecdotally is that the most common form of request, whether it's a warrant or a non-probable cause ECPA order or a subpoena, is give us everything that you can. Give us everything that's in the inbox. Give us everything that's in the sent mail, et cetera, et cetera. However, the vast majority of that email is not going to be relevant to any investigation. We contrast this with what happens in wiretapping cases, where you have a strict time limit, 30 days, and you have a requirement of minimization. This is why when you watch cop shows, they start listening to Tony Soprano's phone, but then it's Meadow talking about her school chums, and they put the phone down. That's minimizing. There's no minimization requirement when they're going after stored data, and yet we're at a point right now when going after all of your stored email is likely going to be more practically invasive than doing a wiretap on you or monitoring your email in real time. And so I think this case highlights this scoping problem. It's good that companies, in some cases, and at some companies, do push back and try and narrow requests when there are gobs and gobs of data at issue. But there's no reason to think that this is actually standard practice, and there's nothing in the law to require it. One hopeful sign, and perhaps something that legislators could look to if they wanted to do some sort of narrowing of this scoping authority, would be to look at Judge Kaczynski's decision in the Ninth Circuit. There was a big data seizure in the Balco doping investigation of data from a company called Comprehensive Drug Testing. And they got a lot of data
on
CDT.
That's a catchy title.
Yeah, CDT. They got totally different CDT. They got a lot of data on the people they were investigating. They also got data on every other athlete who'd ever gone through that drug testing company's system. And Judge Kaczynski, in a decision about this, came up with some great guidance for magistrates about how to limit searches of computer data, which basically involves setting up a taint team of people who are not the investigating officers, having a clear search protocol to figure out what is relevant to the case and only passing that data along to the investigators. I think it would be a great development to see that sort of thing applied in the email search context as well.
So data minimization is a concept in privacy, but as you point out, it's not written into the ECPA as currently constructed. Is that even a reasonable suggestion to consider from a legislative or policy perspective? And if so, how do you implement that? I mean, how do you apply this minimization when, again, if you're law enforcement says, and they said it to me all the time, well, I don't know if I need it until I get it. So how do you apply this minimalization concept, or is it even the right analysis?
I think there is something to be said for minimization, and I think we can look to the wiretap system, to the FISA system as well, which also mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. minimization requirements for FISA wiretaps. But it's also easy to go too far, and I think if you look at Judge Kaczynski's opinion, which ultimately was vacated in terms of being a rule, now it's just guidance, it would have imposed enormous burdens on law enforcement because you would have had to have a third party basically review all the electronic content that was seized from a computer or a network. And it could be a taint team within law enforcement or it could be an independent third party. We're in a situation now where there are far too few law enforcement agents who are devoted to cybercrime or who have the capability to examine and do forensics on digital evidence. So this would basically cut the number of agents in half who could do that. There was also the idea that you could not, to limit fishing expeditions, you could not apply the plain view doctrine to digital evidence. The plain view doctrine is, you know, if I have a search warrant to go into your home to search for a certain shotgun that was used in a murder, and I see a bag of cocaine on your dining room table, I can't take that. I can take that in the physical world. I couldn't do that in the digital world under Kaczynski's ruling. And there were other aspects that, you know, I think would really, really set off alarm bells within law enforcement. I don't think there would be the same alarm bells in the communications world because, for instance, getting a warrant for content, regardless of its age, or getting a warrant even for non-content data, I don't think would be nearly as big a deal as Judge Kaczynski's requirements would be either for communications or for just stored data. So I think minimization can make sense, but there's also you can go too far.
Add here, right, that this, the minimization, the kind of minimization you're talking about is in a way, right, like less onerous than what they're doing in the telephonic context, right? I mean, so having someone in real time sit on the phone and listen to conversations as they're happening to know when to hang up the phone is one reason wiretaps are really, really expensive. If you look at the cost breakdown in the annual report from the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts. In this case, I mean, it seems like, for one, to a substantial extent, and I think this is actually preferable, some of this can be offloaded onto the, I hope you don't mind, but onto the intermediary.
I think you might mind.
Right? I mean, so Google does, in fact, have pretty good technology for sifting through communications.
And targeting ads on them.
Right. One thing this could be used for is to, perhaps narrow the domain of stuff that's being turned over. Give us, you know, the interlocutors you think you're looking for. You know, if in a context where there's already a warrant, maybe there's a series of keywords that we think are being used. And, you know, you might be able to go back, given your initial, you know, cache of stuff that's turned over and say, okay, you know, sort of a second pass, we think the following terms or parameters were also within the scope of our warrant. But to some extent, this is in a searchable format already that renders this a little bit more feasible and practicable.
Well, I'd have to push back on that a little bit, Julian, because as the chief FOIA officer at Homeland Security, everyone wanted everything, right? It's absolutely the same thing as law enforcement. They said, can you help narrow it? No, I don't know what I'm missing. I don't know what I'm doing. And also the labor involved in going back, whether it's on Richard's team or whether it's on the law enforcement, could be pretty onerous in terms of trying to narrow it and then not giving it up and so on. So I'm not sure that putting it on Google or even pushing back and having a multiple-step process would necessarily help. I wanted to follow up on something that you had asked about, which is what do you think a plain view in a computer context would be? Is that the third-party doctrine again? Or I wasn't sure what I was in the proverbial bag of cocaine in my...
The example that comes up constantly in the cases is child pornography. You know, the police are looking for evidence of some other crime, and invariably they come upon child pornography.
But
that's the example, when they're not looking for it.
Sure, okay.
And are you going to ignore it, or are you going to do something about it, investigate it?
And so that's an example where somebody's already gotten processed to get, let's say, for example, emails. And
right.
In the email transactions, they have the child. Okay.
And they see the images.
They see the porn. Okay, I got that.
I mean, I'd just throw up another similar plain view example. You know, we see, okay, we want email regarding this crime, but we're going to end up getting the entire box, and then we're going to find other stuff. Is we're seeing a lot of cases regarding seizure of mobile devices upon arrest. And you could be arrested for a pretty small crime, but then they get your phone, which has gobs and gobs of data. That's the second time I've used the word gobs today. I'll try and avoid it again.
Only if you can make it alliterative.
Yes. I'll work on that. I'll work on that. Googly globs of... I'm sorry, I'm going to stop now. But it is a problem because we are having more and more accounts, devices that contain untold masses of data, more than anything we could have ever comprehended before, that reveal practically every aspect of our life. You know, you took my iPhone right now, you'd learn pretty much everything you ever wanted to know about me. Maybe I shouldn't have said that.
The background context here, right, is a proposal by Professor Oren Kerr from GW in, I think it was in Searches and Seizures in the Digital World. But has proposed revising or rejecting the plain view doctrine here so that because technically the way a search of a hard drive is conducted usually involves, as a first pass, imaging the entire drive to preserve and prevent alteration, that the fact that that is technically how the search has to be carried out shouldn't therefore be interpreted to mean that once the image is there, everything on that drive is plain view and there's no... no sort of further limits on what is then exposed to human review.
So I just throw in one additional way you could think about scoping for ECPA purposes is something proposed by Stephanie Pell, former DOJ, then detailed to House Judiciary and helped draft the Conyers-Nadler ECPA bill that was introduced last year, and Chris Segoyan, professional gadfly and current ACLU staffer, which was to, and they did this in the context of location data, but to require in the application for the order, in this case warrant, something that attests to a nexus between what is being investigated and the scope of the requested data, such that, like, you're putting the onus on them to define a scope that is rationally related to what they're investigating.
What do you think about that, Richard?
Yeah, no, that's almost part of our manual process as it is, where if we're able to glean from the legal process that the event under investigation happened 6 months ago, there may be a good point at that juncture for us to reach out to the agent and say, well, but your warrant is asking for information that could be several years old. Is that really, do you really have probable cause to believe that the information there is going to be of the sort that it's going to be evidence of a crime or it's going to be contraband? Or can we pull this back a little bit? I think our experience would suggest that could have been something that happened at the time of the application to the judge and not when we're reviewing it.
I think to some extent, inevitably, we're going to be driven to a point where we rely on automated processing of data as part of our protection of civil liberties. It happens right now in the FISA world. I mean, NSA collects a lot more information than what they're looking for. And there are people who make the argument that, you know, if it's just machines collecting information but nobody's actually looking at it, it hasn't been collected for all practical purposes.
So if anyone wants to argue about that after this panel.
But it raises the same issues. I mean, is the Fourth Amendment implicated? Is the Fourth Amendment truly implicated if the Fed sees a computer and they're just looking for a tiny sliver of information, but the only way effectively to review that without intruding on privacy with regard to all the other data is to do some sort of automated searches. And there may be problems with that now because our ability to do those sorts of searches using machines and technology is not perfect, but it's certainly advancing quickly, and we see it in civil discovery. I mean, you don't have dozens or hundreds of associates reviewing documents anymore to see what's discoverable to the other side. We use technology and search tools to examine that data and determine what needs to be turned over. So I think there is inevitably going to be the use of that, and courts are going to require it.
So, I mean, is that a legislative solution such that ECPA has to be modified? Is that a reasonable standard? Is that how we should think about this with regard to the production of electronically stored information to law enforcement? And what do you guys think about Mike's proposal?
Can I just answer in one sentence? Realistically, I don't think much of anything has legislative solutions anymore. It's just we don't see it getting done. And this sort of sensitive thing that's going to have to be very fact-based, I think, is going to be left to the courts, for good or ill.
I would focus on keeping the eye on the prize of simply ensuring that at least probable cause is required before content is obtained. I think it's the priority right now and the thing that has the most likelihood of actually happening.
Well, and from a de facto circumstance, if companies like Google are applying the Warshak standard nationwide, even though that's a Sixth Circuit case, I mean, is that essentially going on now? And should we be worried about this? Is Petraeus an anomaly, or is it a good example? What do you guys think?
I'll just say part of the problem is we have Google who's willing to say we require this. We have Facebook willing to say we require this. We don't know that all the other major companies are requiring this. There are a lot of smaller providers who may not even be getting adequate ECPA counseling at all and just handing stuff over in response to a subpoena. And this reflects one of the broader problems with this area of law, which is an utter lack of transparency. We have these wiretap reports that are pretty handy. We don't have anything like that in the ECPA context. We have a handful of companies like Google who are willing to put numbers out. We don't have that comprehensively. So it's hard to say that, oh, well, Warshak solved this problem, because we don't know if Warshak solved this problem, nor do we know how far people are extending Warshak. Warshak on its face was just about email. How does Warshak apply to Dropbox? How does Warshak apply to Facebook social media stuff that is distinct from email? We don't know these things. And so it would be best to codify Warshak in a clear way in statute so that everyone knows what the ground rules are.
A couple of us have mentioned the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts annual report on Title III wiretaps, that's sort of criminal investigation wiretaps. And this is a pretty good model. It's got a great breakdown of how many wiretap orders were granted, how many people on average are tapped, what the average length is, how many convictions result, what the cost is, the types of offenses that are implicated. And in all of these, there's always a little column for the number of wiretap orders that cover electronic surveillance, or let's say, you know, data surveillance as opposed to ordinary voice communications. And it's always like three every year compared to thousands of wiretaps. And usually the three are like fax lines. And the reason is not that investigators are just behind the times and not reading email. It's just that you would never jump through all the hoops that Title III imposes for a wiretap when you can get the same information without all those checks through the Stored Communications Act, what we've been discussing.
So, but to that point, the Administrative Office of the Courts puts that out because they're statutorily required to put that out, right? And taking Mike's heretical concept that legislation isn't going to happen is a
democracy's dead people. Nothing's
it's a crazy concept. But you know, he's right. So okay, fine. So we've got a scenario where we've got something from, you know, my high school age era of legislation that we're trying to apply in a context where you've got ubiquitous computing going on of the size that you know nobody could have conceived of 28 years ago. So, you know, all of these are good things to want, but what should we really be focusing on? What is the prize that we're keeping our eye on? In terms of, you know, where we're going with electronic communications, or we just toss up our hand and say, let them have it.
No, I think, I mean, I'm not so sure I'm as skeptical about the probability of success of legislation, and I think this is going to be a big year in Congress and around privacy, and I think this may be the issue of content being the issue. And I agree completely with Kevin on this, that this is an important legislative initiative, at least with regard to the content. There's other things that could be done to help improve ECPA, but just leveling the requirements so that the government needs the same type of legal process to barge into your house as they do to barge into your Gmail account, I think would be a huge success.
But before I'm burned at the stake, too,
let me invert that.
Let me clarify my heresy. I think there's a pretty good chance that ECPA will be amended to require probable cause for content, regardless of the circumstances. But the question about whether you can address minimization requirements in legislation, I think, is pretty much hopeless. I think it's just too complicated to factor.
On the point of likelihood of something passing, did Mr. Goodlatte happen to say anything about ECPA reform? Because we were actually preparing for this panel when he was speaking.
Did he say the word ECPA? No.
Okay. Just curious. That is a hopeful sign.
Yeah. Okay, great. Anyone want to talk about the legislative kind of aspects, either from the past Congress or this upcoming Congress? Obviously, we don't have anything beyond general statements, but you know, Mike's posited that we maybe have ECPA reform that requires probable cause, but not necessarily minimization.
I mean, so there was a bill introduced by Mr. Leahy in the Senate that addressed location and content issues. He broke off the content part of that and attached it to a Video Privacy Protection Act bill. That passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee on a voice vote, with only Mr. Sessions asking that his no vote be registered, which is a good sign. But then Congress passed the VPPA bill at the end of the year without the ECPA stuff attached. But I think the ECPA content fix is set up quite well in the Senate. The House, less so. There is a Nadler-Conyers bill that addresses both location and content. It as yet does not have any Republican co-sponsors. Meanwhile, Mr. Goodlatte is co-sponsoring with Mr. Chaffetz and a bipartisan selection of about, I don't know, two dozen people, a location fix, which indicates an interest in ECPA reform, at least on the location point. So to the extent I think Mr. Goodlatte decides he would like to work with Mr. Leahy on a bipartisan content fix bill in the House and the Senate, and I think there's a distinct chance we could get a content fix. I think location will be a much harder fight.
Anyone else on that?
So, you know, Julian talked about the wiretap Title III report, and Mike alluded to a couple times a FISA court scenario. Do you think there should be some sort of oversight review similar to that, whether it's ex post in the wiretap context or ex ante in the FISA circumstance, and is that even a realistic thing? Does that go into Mike's heretical pile, or is that something we should think about, or is that realistic from either side?
I think it would be great to have congressional oversight of ECPA and FISA, more searching and real oversight. There is not real oversight of FISA. You know, it's very rare that the Intelligence Committees will look at how FISA is actually being used, and I think there's even less on the criminal side. You know, if you look at the report of Title III wiretaps, you know, what they're giving you is very general numbers about the number of wiretaps and some categories about the types of cases, but that's it. You get very little information, so it's not really possible for anybody to do meaningful oversight with the limited information that's available. And it's just something that I think the congressional committees are not devoting much time to.
Yeah, for what it's worth, the Conyers-Nadler bill that was introduced last year did include a lot of new reporting stuff for ECPA that I think would be a positive change. I also think that it's a great trend to see companies themselves putting out these numbers, which sometimes can be more fine-grained than what we would see in, say, a wiretap report. In other ways, it's less fine-grained. You know, a company's never going to be able to tell us the breakdown of types of offenses that are being investigated, for example. What we'd love to see both from the companies and from the government would be more reporting on which different types of process are being used for which different types of data. You know, warrant for content versus non-content, D orders, 18 U.S.C. 2703 D orders versus subpoenas versus X or Y, for IP address assignment logs versus email to from versus content, et cetera, et cetera.
And there's a sort of a problem of uniformity here that became obvious when Ed Markey got sort of for the first time some records out of the major cell phone carriers about how many law enforcement requests they deal with, and Sprint seemed to have a much bigger number than everyone else. And first, it seemed like because maybe Sprint was the leader in prepaid phones, which anyone who's watched The Wire knows that certain enterprises are very fond of. But it also looked like they were counting things differently. So some entities were counting it as one request if there were multiple orders or subpoenas for the same target over time. Others weren't, or counting each line that was targeted separately, even if it was the same individual with several accounts. And so one value of having the government be the one to do this is that you get a kind of uniformity in the way this stuff is counted and the kind of regularity and ability to compare over time. I mean, in the ECPA context, Magistrate Jeff Stephen Smith has pointed out, it's not just that we don't have aggregate data, it's that very often the what's called 2703D orders that are used to get various kinds of records are bundled with pen trap orders that are sealed, so you end up with this stuff not just not aggregated, but sealed until further action of the court, which in practice means until never. And so it's very difficult to have a sense of what's going on, what the scope of this is. You'd think it would be a no-brainer that, you know, we should have some general picture of how much of this is happening, but Congress generally seems not super interested in that.
Okay.
Have any thoughts about the types of things?
We're always wanting to find ways to improve our reporting, and that's one of them that I think makes sense. And we look at the breakdown by types of legal process. It does turn out to be actually difficult to do because the state and locals have different types of legal process. You have things like court-ordered subpoena. Well, is that a court order? Is it a subpoena? You know, I know how I deal with it as a data disclosure matter, but like just for reporting, it becomes kind of tricky. We did look at this a while ago, kind of rough numbers, and found that 70% of the U.S. legal process we were receiving in these criminal matters was subpoenas, which is about what I would have expected, that the vast majority is going to be requests to identify who a user is, but no content, not a lot of detail about what the user did on the system. The information that can be disclosed with subpoenas listed in the statute with some specificity. There's still some ambiguity there. So that doesn't surprise me. That's how your average case you would expect to be built, is finding out who the person is. Based on that, maybe do some more investigation. You may be able to get the probable cause you need to ultimately get a warrant. So it didn't surprise me that the vast majority was a subpoena. But we do appreciate the suggestions on how to make the report more useful. I have my ideas of how it might be improved, but I don't have the same equities as a lot of others, so I really appreciate the comments on how to make it better.
I have a question for Richard about that. What's interesting to me in the Google statistics is a pretty high percentage of requests that are rejected by Google, not just for the U.S., but around the world, and there's no explanation of why some are rejected, so I'm wondering what some of the more common
I don't. You know, if we tried to categorize all the reasons why we might push back on the legal process, I think we wouldn't have very discrete categories because there's so many ways it can go wrong. But they would include simple things like directing it to the wrong company. I can't tell you how many subpoenas we get for Facebook. And frankly, you know, other than looking up the Facebook account and sending a link, we're really going to push back on that. and little errors like that, and then big errors like sending a subpoena asking for the contents of an account. We're just not going to do that, and we'll give a short response saying, here's the reason why, respectful. And so they do. They're all over the place.
So for the requests that were denied that are in the summary, because I had that similar reaction to Mike, were those ones that were denied, whether it's misaddressed or misprocessed, or were those ones that could have been modified in order for you to comply? Were those outright denials that they had to do new process?
Probably some share of them probably came back to us in a corrected form.
Okay.
So it is possible it's very possible that our numbers where we show, you know, X number of requests we received, actually there's duplicates in some sense, because it came to us as a subpoena for content. We said no. That come back to us with a warrant, we still counted it as two types of legal process.
Okay.
So, yeah, that could happen.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's what I was thinking.
It is worth noting that not everyone is this assiduous. I think EFF put out a report a couple of years ago about national security letters, which are subpoena-like intelligence process, and found that it's an enormous number of the instances that raised red flags that had to be reported to the Civil Liberties Oversight Board was basically involved overproduction by the provider, meaning turning over more information than was legitimately within the scope of the request, and in some cases turning over the contents of an account in response to an SL, which even under the insane sort of post-Patriot Act powers the government has, is not okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious, something you mentioned in your testimony to Congress on this issue a year or two back was the question of bulk requests. That is, and I think the example you used was a request not for a particular targeted user, but give us the account information for all users who have visited a certain website or used a certain service. Can you sort of discuss the context in which you get those?
Well, this is actually one of the Digital Due Process Coalition suggestions for updating ECPA, which is arguably right now under the statute, if all you're requesting as a government agency is basic subscriber information for an account, you just need a subpoena for that. So if you wrote a subpoena that said, all I want is basic subscriber information for every one of your users, arguably under the statute, as a technical, non-sort of human reading, humane reading of the statute, that would be allowed. You could get a lot of data from a simple subpoena. I don't expect we would see legal process like that, because it's just absurd that it's that broad. But you could have variants of that where a lot of people's accounts are covered, and a subpoena is arguably all that is required because of the type of data that is disclosed. So the idea of the principle that we're putting forth in the Digital Due Process Coalition is that let's escalate the legal process so that at least you get in front of a judge before that kind of bulk subscriber data is released.
Do you get stuff like that?
I'm sort of thinking back, this is just anecdotal now, there are probably a handful of cases where the subpoena identifies a target in a broad way such that it could cover many targets. So that does happen. I don't think there's ever been a case where it's just been very nefarious trying to get a massive download of the Gmail users, but probably it's more explained through poor drafting or maybe not as well scoped as the agent had intended. But you do see that.
One instance of that we have seen in the wild that we dealt with at EFF when I was there was a subpoena to the independent, somewhat radical news site, IndyMedia, that asked for the IP address of every single person that visited their website, any page on their website, on a particular day. And this would be a sort of thing that DDP Principle 4 would at least have required a court order for. But I think most of us would say that being able to subpoena basically identifying information on everyone who read a particular political news site on a particular day is somewhat worrisome.
Right, and you might, other than ECPA, you might have a First Amendment basis to challenge
right.
those.
Right, and there may be other statutes as well. We are running out of time, but I do want to open up for a question. Go ahead, sir. If you could be alliterative, that would be great.
I'll work on it. Two questions, and they're related. One is, I haven't heard the word encryption mentioned, and I'm curious if they confiscate a hard drive and it's BitLockered, it's completely encrypted, what do they do then? Do they just say, oh, well, we can't read it? And the other is, I understand that at border crossings, a lot of the protections simply go away, and that if you have something, if you have a device that's encrypted, you can be compelled to provide the key. And so I'm curious, suppose you have secure email. Suppose you're using an encrypted email service or you're just using PGP. What are you adequately protected, or can individual or service provider be compelled to release the data? And what if a hard drive is encrypted? What happens then?
You want to take the encryption?
I want to try and stay within the scope of electronic communications and not go too far into the seizure issue. The issue of searches at the border and searches of encrypted drives at the border is hotly contested. It's something that my colleagues at EFF know better than I do. To the extent you have encrypted email or communications with a service provider and the provider has the keys to that email, yes, they could be compelled to provide that key. If you have encrypted material that the provider does not have keys to, well, then you're better off privacy-wise because they have nothing to hand over and they'd have to come to you, and then you might have arguments on a Fifth Amendment basis or other arguments to avoid handing over that key. But it's worth noting that right now the one statute that deals with this directly is the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which deals with intercept capabilities that are mandated for a variety of types of providers, especially the phone service. And it basically says that it makes clear that there is no duty to create your system in a way such that it can't use end-to-end encryption. That is something we are going to want to make sure we preserve if and when CALEA is sought to be updated this year, which we have heard some intimations might happen.
Any other thoughts on the encryption point in particular?
Just that courts that have looked at this issue have mostly said that there is no Fifth Amendment privilege against being forced to provide your key because it's not testimonial, and what the Fifth Amendment protects against is giving forced testimony.
Although if you're crafty, what you'll do is make your encryption password, I murdered her on the 27th.
It's a password as opposed to a key. Right. Yeah.
Great. Well, we are running out of time. We have the coffee break that's coming up. The only point I would like to make in my own little pitch is we talked a lot about ECPA, but another privacy law, which is the Privacy Act of 1974, may also be implicated with the Petraeus facts in the sense that we had multiple disclosures of information that were held within government system of records. So all of this is interrelated. We have Cable Act issues potentially. We have CPNI issues. So the one thing is it's hard to compartmentalize ECPA, but it's important to think about it in the context of other privacy protections. Thank you very much, panelists. I had a great time.
Thank you. Okay, I got my little